The following podcast is brought to you by the Communication and Media Studies Department at Dominican University of California.
Yeehaw! And welcome everyone to In the Saddle with your host, DJ Iceberg. Strap on your boots and mount up with me as we take a ride through the equine world. Before my men, before my horses. It's actually pretty funny. Horses do like beer, and even Coca-Cola for that matter. But of the two, beer can actually help a horse recover after an event because of the vitamin B complex and the probiotics that are in it. Today, we're going to take a look through the history and evolution of horse jumping. But first, let's go over a few key terms you will hear in the coming minutes. First term is your seat. Now, this is how you sit in your saddle, but it's also just referred to as your butt. So your trainer will say, change your seat. So it means move your butt into whatever position, the correct position. Now, jumping clean means not hitting the fence, or actually there is a little loophole there. You can hit the fence in competition so long as the fence does not come down. Now, this is not for a lot of eventing competitions, but this is for jumpers. Stationary versus mobile fences. Now, I want to go into this one a little bit deeper because stationary fences are very dangerous for the rider and for the horse. Now, a stationary fence is the kind of fence you would see in your backyard. It is in the ground, generally with some sort of reinforcement. And so when a horse hits it, it doesn't move. So it can leave a horse with serious injury, or it can cause a horse to even fall and therefore fall on and injure the rider that is on top of it. Now, a mobile fence is the kind of fence that you see in Olympic jumping. It is two standards, as we call it in horse jumping, two posts that have notches in it that are at specific heights for certain jumps and for competition. And those you just place the pole on top of so that when a horse hits the jump, it moves along with it. Jumping horses started a millennia ago in a much more casual scene than we experience now in the jumping world. It used to be that townspeople would jump over natural obstacles such as logs en route to their location. But eventually, hunters adopted jumping practices in an effort to make their expeditions more effective. Before, they may have decided it was too dangerous to follow their prey over these obstacles, but they were persuaded to try it, being that if they tried to go around the barrier, they might lose sight of the animal. England implemented the Enclosure Acts between 1604 and 1914, with over 5,200 individual acts being put into place. Previously, the land was called common land and was owned by multiple, if not a dozen, people who were then referred to as commoners. Under enclosure, such land was fenced or enclosed and deeded or entitled to one or more owners. The series of enclosure acts throughout this time is what heavily prompted the new interest in jumping. Hunters that were used to chasing foxes through wide open fields for their fur or because of recent attacks on their herds were stopped in their tracks with new fences surrounding them. This had an effect on the breed of horse needed in these areas. With 6.8 million acres gradually fenced off during this time, the people living in these areas learned to jump to make their journeys easier. They also came to learn that jumping over large obstacles was actually pretty fun and exhilarating. And so the first jumping competition was born, and it was known as steeplechasing. Now, this involved a group of generally young people, and they would start at one church, jumping over fences as cleanly and fast as they could to get to the next, using the steeple of the next church as their focal point and finish line. Steeplechasing became popular during the 1700s, before even half of the enclosures were put into place, and it continued being a form of childish entertainment. It was a staple in eventing from 1912 to 2004, but more recently, the only country to still offer the steeplechase is the United States through the Hoylofit USEA Classic events. We will talk more about the steeplechase in episode 3, where it connects with the riding sport eventing. In the mid-1800s, jumping became known as horse leaping. And honestly, I kind of wish that it was still called that because it sounds so much more fun than horse jumping. A large contribution to jumping came from the military. During these centuries, there were many civil wars in the region, leading to a necessity for their troops to be adequate equestrians and specifically jumpers. By the 1800s, multiple European cavalries had adopted jumping practices, but it looked a little different than we see today. The soldiers believed, funnily enough, that a horse's front legs were weaker than their hind. Jump leaning back in the saddle, with their legs stretched forward, so their horses would land with all four legs on the ground, with most of their weight on their hind legs. It wasn't until 1902 when the hilarious original seat was changed by the one we now call the father of modern riding, Italian cavalry officer Federico Caprilli. He watched as riders in competition would force their horses into positions that they were very uncomfortable with and would then refuse to jump. He concluded that he needed to watch a horse jump freely and noticed that their natural movements over the jump without a rider were quite different from a horse with a rider. With this experiment, he found that riders should only be passengers on a horse, following along with their movement and not yanking on their faces. You would think this would be obvious. Sadly, the powers that be did not like the disruption of the status quo that he created and sent him away to be exiled to southern Italy for 3 years. His military chief invited him back to the northern schools years later when he himself tried the position and realized that it actually worked better. The Germans, who had become one of the largest places for horseback riding and for the purchasing of horses, still did not believe in the modern seat at this point and didn't change their style until the 1920s. Sadly, almost 2 decades earlier, Caprilli passed and did not get any acclaim for his act of genius until after he died. Even with his tragic death, the man who would jump over anything in front of him, even a horse-drawn carriage, the man known as the father of modern riding and the Flying Knight, was right. He was right about this new way of jumping, and it changed the game, not just for riders, but for horses. And it was a day of celebration for horses now that their riders were no longer flopping on their back after a fence and ripping at their face. Going back in time a little to 1883, when the first ever U.S. National horseback riding competition was held at Madison Square Garden. By the next year, they would already have 920 members. This remained a national event until in 1909, Alfred Vanderbilt, the president of the National Horse Show, invited the British Cavalry to compete alongside them, making it one of the first ever international horse shows. This competition stayed in the same location for 119 years, over a century, until in 2002, when it was moved to Florida, and then even more recently, to Kentucky. Originally, there were about 40 riders from 8 nations that participated in the Olympics, where they jumped over 15 separate meter 40 obstacles. And for those of you who don't know what that measurement looks like, it's about 4.6 feet. Nowadays, we see these riders soaring over just 14 separate meter 60 fences, which are about 5.2 feet. I don't know why they changed the number of these jumps through the years, but I can hazard a guess as to why they changed the height. I think, and don't quote me on this, but they changed the height because they realized that certain horses had more height potential, giving them the opportunity to create levels within the sport. A molecular archaeologist at the University of Toulouse in France, Lodovic Orlando, said horses are the animal that changed history. Nowadays, with our texts, Snapchats, Instagrams, and any other messaging service, sends our content on to our significant others, friends, and our families at the click of a button, and almost as fast as the speed of light. So, why are horses so historical if technology seems to be more useful to the modern masses than a good old horse? Well, over 6,000 years ago, before the domestication of horses, we didn't have the luxury of texting every minute, obviously. We had letters originally delivered by people who traveled on foot. Because of this way mail had to be delivered, it took longer than our current USPS projected delivery time. Also, while it may be feasible for someone to deliver a letter on foot a few hundred miles away, it is certainly not for thousands of miles. It wasn't until horses were domesticated that people could be connected more easily and rapidly, increasing the transmission of information throughout one or multiple cultures. This discovery also came with the benefit of carrying a larger quantity of goods than any man could carry. First, this came in the form of saddlebags that would hang off the side of a horse's saddle. And then, humans proved that horses could be even more fruitful when they were hitched up to a wagon that could pull up to 6 times their weight. The average horse can run 30 miles per hour, while the average person only runs 7.25 miles per hour, making the horse more than 4 times as fast as that person. There came a time for people to move on from their trusty old steed when the steam engine, the unit of power watts, and horsepower came on the scene. Created by the inventor and engineer James Watts, horsepower intended to measure the power output of a steam engine. As an engineer, he created a steam engine that was more powerful and efficient than his competitors, but he needed proof for his customers. So he developed the horsepower to demonstrate the ability of the machine and show that it would be a sound investment for his customers. He calculated that a horse could turn a 24-foot windmill around 2.5 times per minute. Power is defined as work done per unit time and is calculated by multiplying the force applied by the distance traveled. Using this, James discovered with his work that his engine was 10 horsepower, which is minute compared to the 500 or 700 horsepower engines we see today. But he made a mistake, and he used Shetland ponies, which are those tiny, fluffy, super cute ponies, instead of real horses. And while he did account for their size, adjusting the numbers to what he thought a horse would be, he overestimated, so the current definition of 1 horsepower is about 70% of the original horsepower. Now, I don't know what kind of tools they had back then to measure this kind of thing, but I think that for his time, it is still very impressive. While this is not related to horses, you may recognize the name Watts because he happens to be the inventor of the Watt. And if you don't know what a Watt is, go to Home Depot and look at the packaging around light bulbs. Now, I've given you this information to say that arguably the domestication of horses is one of the most important technological advancements in the totality of human history. Horses change the perspective of distance and influence the course of human migration across the globe. And you know, I'm not the biggest fan of history, but I could talk about the history of horseback riding all day, because it has to do with one of the things that I love most, horses. And on this show, there will be no shortage of horsey information. I hope you found this podcast as interesting and enjoyable as I found my supplementary research, Until next time, iceberg out.